also been implicated in this plan. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others took an active role in the war on Syria, throwing money, weapons, and unlimited support behind various terrorist groups. Other Arab countries like Egypt and Jordan stood idly by, distancing themselves from Syria and passively towing the official narrative that President Bashar al-Assad must be removed. Fast forward to 2021, and now those same countries are trying to normalize ties with the Syrian government. Ostensibly, the United States is fuming as its regional allies in the Middle East seek rapprochement with Damascus. So why now? What's the strategy here? Are these countries acting on their own accord, or did they get the prior okay first from Washington? How come these countries want to buddy up again with Syria, and how does it benefit both sides? Aside from trying to topple the Syrian government, the United States has claimed since 2014 that it's busy launching limited precision strikes against Daesh inside Iraq and Syria. Is it? That's not what the latest investigation by the New York Times says. A recent report shows that U.S. forces killed dozens of Syrian women and children in 2019 and then tried covering it up, literally, by bulldozing the site so no one would find out. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The war on Syria began in 2011 during the protests of the Arab Spring. While Egypt and Tunisia experienced enormous popular uprisings, that's not quite what happened in Libya and Syria. Syria had protests to a certain degree, but it quickly became apparent who and what was behind these calls to topple the government. It wasn't just Syrians out on the streets protesting, seeking change and an overhaul of the system. It was also foreign governments trying to change the political landscape in the Middle East, who were meddling inside Syria and trying to bring about regime change. These foreign governments and their terrorist proxies soon proved to be the most dominant actors in the war on Syria. The United States, United Kingdom, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Israel, Turkey, and many others were sending money, arms, and training terrorist groups inside Syria. This is a well-documented fact. These same countries tried to isolate Syria in the international community and the United Nations. Syria's diplomatic ties have been severed with dozens of countries. The list is too long to mention. And they put Syria under heavy sanctions, both the US and the European Union. Many cut ties, and that was that. Syria was isolated, and still is today to an extraordinary degree. Syria, whose nickname in Arabic is Qalb al-Arub al-Nabida, the beating heart of Arabism, was even kicked out of the Arab League. That's how much the politics in the region were manipulated against Syria. The Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, was smuggling weapons from Libya to Syria to support terrorist groups fighting the government. But some Arab countries were also supporting their own groups in Syria. Qatar was funding terrorist groups like Falaq al-Rahman or Jabhat al-Nusra, which is essentially a rebrand of Al-Qaeda. Meanwhile, the Saudis threw their support behind organizations like Jaish al-Islam and Ahrar al-Sham. Fast forward to 2021, and now the situation is completely different. Despite throwing all this money and sending all these foreign fighters to Syria, it didn't work. The last couple of months, we've seen an extraordinary shift as many Arab countries have indicated their willingness for rapprochement with Damascus. A country like Saudi Arabia, which was funding terrorist groups to overthrow the Syrian government, is now saying it wants to mend ties with Syria as if nothing happened. Just look at this example from a few months ago in June from Al Jazeera. They reported Saudi Arabia is close to reaching an agreement on diplomatic normalization with President Bashar al-Assad's government. Incredible, isn't it? In September, Egypt and Jordan, who weren't on speaking terms with Syria since the beginning of the war, are now suddenly cooperating with al-Assad so they could send Egyptian gas and Jordanian power through Syria to help Lebanon. This was done at the behest of the United States, scared that Hezbollah was growing too popular in Lebanon. Later that same month, Reuters reported that Jordan's King Abdullah received a phone call from Syrian President al-Assad, the first since the start of the war in 2011. A week later, in early October, Jordan proceeded to open its main border crossing with Syria. During the latest UN General Assembly in New York, the Syrian foreign minister had meetings not just with the Egyptian foreign minister, but eight other Arab foreign ministers. The latest sign of normalization came in early November from the United Arab Emirates. The foreign minister of the UAE, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed, came to Damascus to meet with al-Assad personally. Given all these recent developments, there's no doubt that we're seeing a huge shift in attitude from Arab countries towards Syria. But why is that exactly? To talk more, I wanted to bring on Tim Anderson. He joins me from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Tim is an Australian writer, activist, and academic. He's also the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, a virtual network that was founded over concerns of academic body censorship on anti-imperial research. Tim, thanks so much for taking the time. It's a pleasure to have you on. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is rapprochement or normalization of ties with Syria. What do you think is behind this change in attitude? What has changed the equation here? Is it the president, the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, or perhaps the advance of Yemeni forces as the Houthis are part of the resistance axis? Why exactly are we seeing so many Arab countries change their position in regards to Syria?
Yes, it's related to the whole region. You're right in that respect. And of course, the U.S. has always seen the whole region as its project, not individual wars. You know, there have been at least 8 wars, arguably 9 if we include Bahrain, in the last 20 years. And that's part of a project that was given a name, the New Middle East, 15 years ago by Condoleezza Rice when she was in Jerusalem just before the Israelis invaded Lebanon again. So what's been happening is they've been losing several wars, as you mentioned. They withdrew from Afghanistan. They have a schedule to withdraw what they call combat troops from Iraq. You know, that may be weasel words there. They are certainly in discussions at the moment to withdraw troops from Syria. And as you pointed out, the Saudis are in trouble in Yemen, and they've been suing for peace for the last couple of years, but they haven't proposed any decent sort of terms. So I think in that context, and also in the context of the contradictions of the economic blockade, let's not call them sanctions, the economic blockade against most of the independent countries here and the peoples of the region here, the US's, or the Biden administration, let's say, has had to start to make some adjustments. It made some adjustments for Lebanon when the country was on the verge of starving and not having any fuel. There was pressure from the Emiratis, who actually went and normalized with Damascus 3 years ago. And then Trump, of course, used that against them to force them to normalize with Israel and blackmail them on that one. But nevertheless, the Emiratis wanted to get back, and having lost the war of all the proxy armies they sent into Syria, some of those countries really, for their own reasons of investment and trade and whatever, wanted to re-establish ties with Syria and not be completely excluded. And so Jordan was the other one. Jordan, probably the weakest of all of the Arab countries, totally dependent on its relationship with the US, also did some sort of normalization recently. So I think you're seeing them, the UAE to a certain extent, certainly Jordan and Lebanon, getting permission from the US to reopen ties to a certain degree, against what the very strong third-party economic blockade measures that Trump put in place called the Caesar sanctions. So the Biden administration has not removed those laws, but it's been making exceptions more or less while maintaining the framework of a large number of laws that constitute this blockade.
And that's a very interesting point, because I wanted to ask you about that. Do you think they're acting of their own accord, or they had to get an okay from the United States and Israel? Because, you know, it is a contradiction in how the United States views Syria and how they view Syria now.
Yes, the U.S. Certainly gave permission to Jordan, and I believe also to the Emiratis. Their foreign minister was here recently. It was a big deal. It was a diplomatic coup for Syria in a way. It was also a type of a green light for the Emiratis to proceed with investment projects, which they've been looking at, and they have some in train, but they've been holding back for the last 3 years, but I believe that's now going ahead. So I think they needed permission from the US. Of course, remember, all of these collaborating states are very vulnerable to the US, and Trump proved that when he forced the Emiratis and Bahrain, wasn't it, to recognize Israel, the so-called, some other accord, some agreement where they...
Abraham Accords, yeah.
Abraham Accords, that's right, yeah.
When Blinken, the Secretary of State, he says that the United States opposes any attempts to rehabilitate or normalize ties with Syria. Is he just puffing his chest?
Yes, well, that's happening to a certain degree. I mean, it is bluster, but it's also, they know they've been fighting a losing war in Syria and Iraq for a number of years now. They they don't mind making exceptions for certain people, and by which they still hold the power to prevent things from happening, basically. But, it appears that there's big contradictions, because the Lebanese are coming in, the Jordanians are coming in, the Emiratis are coming in. The Saudis have been talking to Damascus also.
Right.
But that's not really out in the open yet. But nevertheless, the U.S. is maintaining its posture that of a bad loser. I mean, they're always bad losers, aren't they? You know? I recall Vietnam, they fought for at least 7 years, knowing that they were losing in Vietnam. Then they imposed so-called sanctions, a blockade on Vietnam for a number of years too, which persisted into the 80s. You know, so that's why I wouldn't be surprised to see the occupation, US occupation. Remember, there's three occupations of Syria now. The two largest NATO armies, Turkey and the US, are occupying large parts of Syria. And, of course, Israel has been occupying the southern part for 50 years. So the US occupation is all along the border, the critical borders of Syria, on the eastern borders with Iraq and also with Jordan, except for one point where al-Baghouz is. So one of the key points of the US occupation, I believe, is to prevent the links strengthening between Iran, Iraq, and Syria. That's really quite a critical part of their classical divide and rule strategy.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
You mentioned the massacre, which was unearthed by the New York Times recently. This article talks about a U.S. airstrike inside Syria near a town called Baghouz. On March 18th, 2019, American forces killed upwards of 60 Syrian civilians. Let me just read you a few lines from the article. A U.S. military drone circled high overhead, hunting for military targets, but it saw only a large crowd of women and children huddled against a riverbank. Without warning, an American F-15E attack jet streaked across the drone's high-definition field of vision and dropped a 500-pound bomb on the crowd, swallowing it in a shuddering blast. As the smoke cleared, a few people stumbled away in search of cover. Then a jet tracking them dropped one 2,000-pound bomb, then another, killing most of the survivors. They go on to say in the article that the assessments of the airstrike were carried out by the same unit which called in the airstrike. This is a unit called Task Force 9, right? So it's basically like the police department investigating itself for police brutality. And of course, this unit rarely found problems with its own work. No conflict of interest there, I'm sure. After this investigation, the New York Times sent its findings to U.S. Central Command. This is the response that it got. The command acknowledged the strikes for the first time, saying 80 people were killed, but the airstrikes were justified. It said the bombs killed 16 fighters and 4 civilians. As for the other 60 people, the statement said it was not clear that they were civilians, in part because women and children in the Islamic State sometimes took up arms. Right, so according to the statement, they just assume that the other 60 people they murdered were maybe combatants because sometimes women and children under Daesh took up arms. Well, it turns out this was also a lie, because in the article, people who saw the drone footage say there weren't 16 men at all. It was 2 or 3 men who were just walking around. They weren't even in combat. Now, this American unit, Task Force 9, was just going around Syria, murdering civilians, and then claiming it was self-defense. They see a car driving, they just claim it looks threatening, and then they call in an airstrike. Oh, we saw someone with a gun, call in an airstrike. They would lie and make up all sorts of things, anything to pretend that they were acting in self-defense. They actually did this so much that about 80% of all airstrikes called in by this unit were claimed in self-defense. And you can guess, of course, what that leads to. Thousands and thousands of civilians killed. In the article, they say that, quote, a number of Syrian towns, including the regional capital, Raqqa, were reduced to little more than rubble. Human rights organizations reported that the coalition caused thousands of civilian deaths during the war. Hundreds of military assessment reports examined by the Times showed the task force was implicated in nearly 1 in 5 coalition civilian casualty incidents in the region. This Task Force 9 was killing so many people that even the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, that has killed God knows how many people in assassinations, wars, and coups around the world, grew alarmed. CIA officers alleged that in about 10 incidents, the secretive task force hit targets knowing civilians would be killed. And then the rest of the article, they go into detail of how people like Colonel Corsack and Mr. Tate tried raising the alarm that a war crime had been committed, only to be ignored and stonewalled. At one point, they even fired Tate from the Inspector General's office and escorted him out of the building by security because he wouldn't stop raising the issue of this massacre.
Yes, I think you're right to say that it's one of the massacres, but this particular one, which came out in the New York Times, is of a village which is right on the border of Syria and Iraq at the Euphrates, just below Al-Bukamal, which is normally spoken of as the major town near the border there. And that's been a critical, it's been a hot point. Now, the U.S. claims now that this was part of their final operations against ISIS. But this is a facade because we know really they have been backing covertly ISIS for many, many years. Joe Biden admitted it 7 years ago. That he admitted it indirectly that his close Arab allies were financing. And the head of the U.S. military at that time, General Martin Dempsey, admitted that his close Arab allies were financing ISIS. And I myself went to a site in Deir ez-Zor 4 years ago where the year before the U.S. and the Australians had bombed the Syrian army to allow ISIS to take over the mountain behind the airport at Deir ez-Zor. Now, the one we're talking about now, Al-Baghouz village, is on the Euphrates. It was March 2019, so in other words, more than a year after all of the major operations were finished against ISIS, that ISIS was driven out of all of the major towns and cities of Iraq and Syria, and that was announced by General Qasem Soleimani, you might remember, who was the leader of that project. And also, by the way, the leader who decided to go from, after the liberation of Deir ez-Zor city from Daesh in October 2017, it was Soleimani that decided to go on immediately, straight away, down through Al-Ma'idin, down to Al-Bukamal and take control of the border there. And that border site around this village where we're talking about now, where the massacre took place, where the U.S. admits the massacre took place, is where Iran has set up some facilities, some security facilities, which has been attacked many, many times by unknown forces, but presumably Israelis and the U.S. There's been missile strikes many, many times on the Iraqi and Syrian side of that border, the border crossing, which of course is the one border crossing that Syria and Iraq are still controlling, but it's under heavy fire. Now, it just so happens, Al-Baghouz is right at that point. So there wasn't really, there certainly are bands of ISIS still around eastern Syria, but they've been effectively sheltered by the U.S. occupation in eastern Syria. And to some extent, I was told this in Hasakeh, that the Qassab, the SDF groups, which have a lot of ISIS prisoners, let groups out from time to time to go down for operations down near Deir ez-Zor and down in southeastern Syria. In fact, there was a petition by prisoners in one of the jails there. There was a type of insurrection, and they were demanding to go down to Al-Tanf base, the U.S. base, on the border of Syria, Jordan, and Iraq, because they thought the conditions were better down there, and the U.S. was going to allow them to, you know, participate in some other sort of operations there.
The United States claims that they're fighting ISIS during this time. I mean, they claim the same thing in Iraq, and we can see what happened to Mosul, to Raqqa, also. I mean, They flattened these cities, really, and they've committed atrocities, war crimes, but they seem to get away with it, right? And there's this sort of hypocrisy here where when Syria is fighting terrorists, they say that Syria is indiscriminately killing civilians, but we don't hear that about the United States, right? It's as if there's always a good enough reason for them to do that. Do you feel there's a double standard there in how this is treated by the media and the politicians?
Well, certainly, as regards the Western media, I mean, because they're very deeply embedded with the Western states, aren't they? Effectively, it's not permissible in Western countries to contradict fundamentally the narrative that the U.S. has re-entered Iraq, for example, to fight ISIS. That has been a pretext. Of course, from time to time, they bomb people, they kill people. Also in Idlib, to some extent, every now and then they say they've killed an al-Qaeda leader there, but we know that NATO as a whole has been funneling aid and arms into that other side of northern Syria. I just make one other point about the Al-Baghouz, this village. As I said, Soleimani and the Syrian forces took control of that area and that border crossing in late 2017, just as the major occupation of ISIS was defeated. Now, that is the area that's been attacked many, many times. So ask yourself, 15-16 months after that, when the Iranians, the Syrians, the Iraqi resistance were embedded in that area, why would there be any ISIS target there for the US to bomb? This is really, they wouldn't be a large aggregation of ISIS in that area anyway, because it's an area controlled specifically by the three powers, like Iran, Iraq, Syria. And of course, the incident that I documented a few years earlier around Deir ez-Zor was similar in a way. It shed some light on this. There's a case where the US and Australians, and I think the Danes, some others, went in, bombed the mountain behind Deir ez-Zor, which was controlled by the Syrian army, killed over 120 Syrian soldiers, claimed it was a mistake. It was a well-planned operation. But that operation allowed ISIS to take over the mountain to get strategic advantage at a time when there's still a battle going on for the city. This is in September 2016. Now, the US didn't come back and bomb ISIS on that mountain. They were very happy to leave ISIS there. And, of course, as it turns out, they failed. They couldn't take over Deir ez-Zor city. So all of those operations in that part of Syria have been really clouded by this false pretext that the US was there fighting ISIS. I spoke to a senior general in Deir ez-Zor 4 years ago, General Shahada, and I said to him after he was explaining how, and this was reported in the Iraqi and Iranian media a great deal, but of course not in the Western media, that there were these constant observations of collaboration between the US occupation and ISIS at that time. But there was one other incident, and that was, he said, that a group of Syrian soldiers were attacked and killed in the desert on one occasion there in 2017, and it was not possible that they could have detected them without satellite intelligence. So they believed that the US were providing satellite intelligence to ISIS too. And so I asked him if he thought he was fighting a US commander, and he said 100% that the US was directing ISIS operations at that time. That's what the Syrians think.
It's absolutely incredible, all these examples. You know, it's almost too hard to believe, but this is effectively what's going on. Professor, just perhaps as a last question, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but, you know, in Afghanistan, just when the U.S. was withdrawing from Kabul, you know, they drone-striked the Ahmadi family and claimed it was an accident after investigating themselves. And then here again, the United States military investigates itself and finds no wrongdoing.
No, of course not. But this is what they do, isn't it? I mean, it's just they will always do it. You may recall the George Bush the First said after they shot down an Iranian civil airliner, "I'll never apologize for anything the U.S. does." Yeah. In Vietnam, we had the same experience. Basically, they even though they spoke of, you know, destroying a village to save it and those sorts of things, nevertheless, that level of cynicism has been there for a very long time through very many wars.
So much for America's checks and balances, right? So not only did the soldiers cover up their own crimes, but the commanders covered up their crimes, the bureaucracy covered up their crimes, even the grave itself was covered up. Literally, they covered it up using bulldozers. They razed the site and buried all the bodies so no one would find out. And of course, no one is held accountable for this, not one person. You can invade the land of Arabs and Muslims, murder them for no reason, and just get away with it. And then they talk about democracy and human rights, and they pretend that they are the civilized ones, and they will come teach us how things are done. The only thing being taught here is violence. The only lesson being drawn from this is that the United States will kill civilians with impunity on the other side of the globe and then cover it up from the soldiers all the way up the chain of command to the commanders and bureaucrats in D.C. Look how long it took before we even found out about this. 2 years. They almost got away with it too. Can you imagine what else they are hiding? This is just the tip of the iceberg. They did this in Vietnam. They did this in Afghanistan. Just look a few months ago in August. While they were withdrawing, the U.S. murdered an entire family in Kabul with a drone strike. And for weeks, they lied and pretended they had killed ISIS fighters. They had killed Daesh K. You think they would have admitted to the murder if the media hadn't brought it up like they did now with Syria? Never. The whole war on terror is a lie. Fighting Daesh, also a lie. The whole war on Syria, based on lies. Look at the normalization and the lessons from that. One day they call it Assad a dictator, the next they say he's an Arab brother. This shows you how politics is all theater. From 1 second to the next, they flip like that. Nothing changed except their interests and whether their masters in Washington, D.C. gave them the okay. And these strikes, these massacres, no civilized person can accept this barbarism. No one can tolerate this foreign aggression and violence. Nobody. There's nothing democratic or humane about these bombs. There is no such thing as precision or limited strikes. These are massacres, bloodbaths. And anyone saying otherwise is either a fool or a liar. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A top human rights official at the United Nations has concluded that new voting restrictions pushed by conservatives in Texas and other U.S. states are diluting the political representation of people of color in the United States, where human rights protections are far from comprehensive and even incoherent. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Ludwig, journalist. This article is published under the heading, UN Human Rights Envoy Slams Racist Voter Suppression in U.S. Stay tuned for more. A top human rights official at the United Nations has concluded that new voting restrictions pushed by conservatives in Texas and other states are diluting the political representation of people of color in the United States, where human rights protections are far from comprehensive and even incoherent. I conclude that there is, in fact, what could be described as an undermining of democracy, with a phenomenal number of legislative measures in different parts of the country, which have the effect of making the exercise of the right to vote more difficult for certain minorities, said Fernando Varens, the special rapporteur on minority issues for the UN Human Rights Office, during a press conference recently. Though Varens has met with government officials, experts, and civil rights groups in multiple states, as well as Puerto Rico and Guam, where he decried the lacking of national political representation for the people living in these U.S. territories. His visit comes nearly 60 years after Black revolutionary leader Malcolm X called on UN human rights officials to indict the U.S. government for anti-Black racism and oppression, a problem that Malcolm X said the U.S. could not even begin to address in the absence of international pressure and solidarity among people of African descent. following two-week tour of the U.S., Doe Varens urged policymakers to overhaul the nation's human rights laws to combat a dramatic increase in discrimination, hate speech, and hate crimes against Black, Latinx, Asian, and Indigenous people. Millions of Americans, especially people of color, are also threatened by growing economic inequality, environmental pollution, and disparities in healthcare and education, he said. Though there were significant and hard-won human rights gains made mainly during the civil rights movement in the 1960s, the United States stands out among Western democracies for its incomplete patchwork of human rights recognition and their legal protection, with minorities and indigenous peoples most likely left behind in times of upheaval, uncertainty, and crisis, he said. The UN envoy's comments also come as Republicans continue to block voting rights legislation in Congress and push statewide restrictions on voting fueled by former President Trump's thoroughly debunked yet persistent claims of election fraud. Doe Varens was particularly concerned about Texas, where he said new voting restrictions passed into law by Republicans are expected to have a disproportionate impact on growing urban populations that threaten conservative political dominance in the state. Doe Varens said the voting law known as SB1 limits what poll workers can do to protect voters from partisan poll watchers who could harass or intimidate voters. Since Democrats won the White House and a slim majority in Congress in 2020, Republicans in at least 19 states have passed 33 laws making it harder for people to vote. Citing a decline in civil liberties and Trump's efforts to overturn the election he lost, the National Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance recently added the U.S. to its list of backsliding democracies alongside countries such as Poland and Slovenia. Trevor Potter, president of Campaign Legal Center and a former GOP chairman of the Federal Election Commission, pointed to recent attempts by Republicans in Wisconsin to undermine a bipartisan elections agency and even threaten its members with criminal for charges making it possible for residents of nursing homes to vote during the pandemic. Potter said in a statement recently, "In recent months, partisan attempts to undermine legitimate and fair American elections have found shocking amounts of support and gained a concerning amount of traction. Though state lawmakers in both parties are also redrawing electoral maps to maximize their political power, Republicans have an advantage due to their control of more state legislatures. Aggressive gerrymanders that dilute the electoral power of communities of color in states such as Texas and Georgia could provide Republicans with avenues for taking control of Congress in the midterm elections without winning the popular vote." Noting the murder of George Floyd and other high-profile police perpetrated killings of Black people, Doe Varens said Black people in the U.S. are most likely be imprisoned, denied their right to vote, and targeted by hate speech and social media. He added that indigenous people in the U.S. and its territories have experienced centuries of dispossession, brutality, and even genocide. Systematic racism disadvantaged oppressed groups within the U.S. criminal legal system, one reason why Black and brown people are disproportionately locked up in the nation's vast systems of jails and prisons. "I have been informed that minorities such as African Americans and Latinx in particular find themselves disproportionately at the receiving end of the marginalization and criminalization that crushes them into a generational cycle of poverty," with a legal system that is structurally set up to advantage and forgive those who are wealthier and penalizing those who are poorer, particularly minorities of color, Doug Warren said. While he did not mention Trump or Biden by name, Doug Warren did commend the U.S. government for making significant changes since 2020 elections, including executive orders and hate crimes legislation in the wake of increasing violence and hate crimes against Asian Americans. However, Doug Warren concluded that the U.S. must pass comprehensive national legislation to guarantee human rights for oppressed communities and live up to its international obligations and lofty rhetoric. The human rights experts will submit a final report on human rights for minorities in the U.S. to UN Human Rights Council in Geneva in March 2022. Doug Warren's report will come almost six decades after Malcolm X sought to internationalize the issue of black oppression by bringing it to the United Nations as a human rights issue. The UN Human Rights Council avoided interfering with U.S. domestic politics for decades after Malcolm X's death in 1965, although in recent years officials have toured the U.S. and weighed in on the impacts of current policy. In June 2020, the UN Council formally acknowledged Malcolm X's request and finally adopted a resolution on human rights violations perpetrated by law enforcement against people of African descent as uprisings for racial justice raged across the U.S. Speaking at the founding rally of the Organization for Afro-American Unity in 1964, Malcolm X said the U.S. government is not morally equipped to solve the problem of racism. He said, "We feel that the problem of black men in this country is beyond the ability of Uncle Sam to solve it. It's beyond the ability of the United States government to solve it. The government itself isn't capable of even hearing our problem, much less solving it. It's not morally equipped to solve it."
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Assalamu alaikum, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station, Choo Choo Kachoo, it's the Youth Station for you. All aboard, here in the studio today we have with us Sayyid Abdullah. Good to have you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's good to be here, as always.
I'm Muzaffar Haider. Alright, so who's your biggest enemy?
I won't tell you, how about you tell me yours?
You don't want to tell me? Wow, man.
You tell me, I'll tell you.
No, you
so
you're
asking the question, I'm asking the question back.
All right, fine. My biggest enemy is me.
Yourself?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I.e. the devil. No, I have lots of enemies, man. Where do I start?
I mean the major enemy, like the one that stands out, the one that's
okay,
fine,
I'll just say, enemy. And he is to you a manifest enemy, Shaitan. Iblis himself.
So first you say yourself, now I say Shaitan. Which one?
I'd like to say that we are our own worst enemy, because Shaitan is easy to fight, and you know, you're the only barrier between yourself and overcoming him.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it goes. They're both right. Mm. It's both of them. What about you now? Come on.
Well, actually, I was going to say the same thing. Hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, O Amir al-Mu'mineen. I can't remember which one, but it might be the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. He says, "A'da'uka nafsuka allati bayna jambayk." The worst of your enemies is a soul that's between your you know, your broad shoulders or your heart or your chest, whatever you want to, jembeik, you want to translate it. So the worst of your enemies is actually your soul, yourself.
Yourself.
And Shaitan, he just comes for the ride. He just finds a wild horse and he just rides it. You are the worst, you know, you become the worst enemy to yourself.
So when Islam is saying that, you know, yourself is your worst enemy, what does it actually mean?
Okay, you're an enemy of yourself because you would, see, when it comes to enemy, what does the enemy want to do? The enemy's job is to harm you in any possible way, to cause you harm.
Yeah.
Now, when you, for example, commit sins, what are you doing to yourself?
Are you harming yourself.
You're throwing yourself literally in the pits of hellfire. Mm. There's nothing worse than that.
Yeah.
So who is the worst enemy now? You are.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can't. You are literally being destructive to yourself to the extent you're harming it in a way where there is no return, eternity in hellfire.
Yeah.
So you are the worst enemy to yourself because your enemy might want, I don't know, take your money. Maybe they want to cause you a bit of physical harm. Maybe they want to destroy your reputation in society. So they have, you know, limited damage they could do. But you could do the ultimate damage. You can take yourself one-way ticket, first class, on Qatar Airways to hell.
Yeah.
That can't get worse than that.
Yeah. Isn't that terrifying?
It is terrifying.
You are an enemy that you can never escape.
It is terrifying. So unless you work on yourself, I mean, even Shaitan himself, I think we mentioned this previously, he's weak against you, but you're the one who is in charge of things. If you let yourself loose, then even Shaitan will take, actually he will sit back and he'll just watch the show. He's like, what else can I do that this guy is not doing already?
Yeah.
He doesn't even come to you. I remember one of the ulama, he's talking about a special group, I don't want to name name. He said, like, Shaitan has nothing to do with them. You know, he comes to you. The aqa'id is destroyed, their beliefs are destroyed, their ibadah is destroyed. There's nothing he can do. There's no more damage he can do to these guys. And he said he let them be. He just sits and watches the show. He's like, he comes to me and you, which our aqa'id are, you know, at least it's intact and we're doing, you know, seemingly the right thing. So he comes, fights us, right? But then it's ultimately up to us to, you know, either have that shield, put an antivirus to Shaitan, or we could, no, we become antivirus and there's, you know, whatever, you know, you can browse the internet and you can see how you go. So it's you are the worst to yourself.
Brother Abdullah, do you mind if we go for a short break?
Sure.
Here we go, we'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome to Youth Station, in which Brother Abdullah and I are talking about the biggest enemy. Let's say that there is a society out there, there's a qawm out there, and they are completely riddled in sins. They've got music all around them, haram music, ghina. There's so many layers of corruptive ideologies that have been built around such a society that in order for somebody to climb out of that and get towards Allah, it's almost like there's like 99 layers that they have to break through, right?
Exactly. So they're on autopilot.
They're on autopilot.
Yeah.
Which means that the shaitan, like if you were shaitan,
there's nothing to do.
What would you attack?
Nothing.
What would be your primary target? I think it would be the Hawza, wouldn't it?
You've spoken about the bad people who live in a society which is corrupted. But sometimes, even Muslims, for example, take, let's say, for example, Wahhabis. Oh, forget about the Wahhabis. ISIS. They seemingly trying to do Allah's job. So they are Muslims by name, or at least, you know, let's say not all ISIS, but some of them. By name, they're Muslims. They studied the Quran. They studied the Hadith. They're so much into their Islam that they want to establish this system on earth that Allah wants, the system of Khilafah. Now, even those who are working in the name of Allah, Shaitan says, I have nothing to do with these guys. Like, I mean, I've done the job. I mean, they are on autopilot too.
Yeah.
So you can be on a corrupted system on an autopilot, and you could be in an Islamic system, and you could also be on an autopilot. Because if your aqa'id are wrong, your amal is wrong. Your amal is wrong, you're going to one-way ticket to hell as well.
Yeah.
So he's also on autopilot. He comes to me and you where he says, okay, their aqa'id is okay. Their aqa'id is intact. These are my main, I don't know, competitors. These are the targets that I want to get. So he comes to me and you, and then you, we have this battle of temptation.
Okay, so how do we fight it? How do we fight him in particular? I mean, the self, let's leave that for a different discussion. That guy, that thing, that entity, that jinn that exists, and he's very powerful in the sense that he doesn't die. He's not going to die until the Day of Judgment, maybe, right? So how do we fight that?
Well, that's a problem, Brother Muzaffar. You can't fight him unless you fight yourself.
Uh-huh.
It begins within you, not with him. You can't defeat your external enemy when you are weak from the inside. How are you going to defeat him with what? With your iman, which you don't have? Mm-hmm. With your amal, which you're not practicing? What are you going to defeat him with? So unless you tap it into your inner soul and increase your iman, increase your faith, increase your amal, you build your defense towards shaitan. You know what I mean? Then you can counter attack. I mean, if you're playing a game, I don't know, have you played Age of Empires?
Yeah.
Unless you build your own fortress and your own army defenses, you can't go fight other civilizations. First, you have to be strong. So with even Allah says, like, when it comes to your nafs, you have to be strong in yourself. Like, you have to really have this self-control and, you know, what have you, in order for you to resist this temptation. If my willpower is weak, I can't resist this temptation.
Mm.
Music, I don't know, let's look at haram, let's see haram, let's do haram.
Mm.
It becomes a lot easier for him because my willpower is too weak.
Mm.
So I need to come to myself and force myself, build my fortress, strengthen my willpower, then I can defend him. So imagine me and you trying to go to war. I don't know a Muzaffar, you know.
Mm.
I come to you without no weapons.
Mm.
You will defeat me with a slap.
Mm.
Right?
No,
I mean, you know the point I'm trying to say. So unless I go learn karate and kickboxing and all the self-defense myself, then I could confidently walk into an arena or a street, and if anyone wants to attack, I can defend myself.
Okay, so what? Let's say that you are defending yourself, like you've actually learning that kung fu, that fighting, and you know you've gone to a teacher, and he's giving you ways that you can defend yourself. Now he's giving you the weaponry. What would that weaponry be?
Well, first is ilm, as you say, al-ilmu silah, right?
Mm-hmm.
And knowledge is power. Knowledge is a weapon. If you have the knowledge. Even if you look at the Quran beautifully, Allah always brings these two words together. الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ. He never brings amal without iman. He never brings iman without amal. They're always constant. So first you need to have the iman, knowledge. So without knowledge, your amal would be fruitless.
Mm-hmm.
It would be pointless, and it would be fertile. It would go to vain.
Yeah.
It will disappear.
Yeah.
So unless you have this iman, which is knowledge, so the more you increase your knowledge, and then you put that knowledge into practice, there you go. Then you are building.
I think a part of that knowledge is actually recognizing that he exists. I mean, in the West, a lot of the times people
him
just
the enemy, shaitan.
Shaitan exists.
No, obviously.
Yeah.
So why are me and you are learning these things?
There's a big kind of current and push to make everything about the nafs. And while I 100% agree with what you said, I do feel like they've kind of tried to push shaitan out of the equation. You know, as the Christians say, the biggest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world that he doesn't exist, right? And so I feel like a lot of Muslims have forgotten that it's actually a real entity. He is He has a personality. He is almost human-like, but not human, obviously. He's a jinn.
Yeah.
We've forgotten that. Yuwaswisu fi suduri nas min al jinnati wan nas. He whispers into the hearts of men, from among the men and from among the jinn.
Mm.
Forgetting that he exists, i.e. not having the knowledge of his existence, is completely plays into his favor.
Mm.
I'll give you an example. There are some thoughts that exist and they belong to us. But there are some thoughts we have to recognize as alien. They don't belong to
us
at all.
Yeah.
There was this woman, she killed her kids. She drowned her two babies. And then when they asked her why, she said, because the voices told me that if I don't kill them, they won't go to heaven. Mm. Right? Now, that's not something that is naturally born out of the human mind, no matter what the psychologists might try and tell you.
Sure.
That's not human, okay? Mm. That is whispering from entities other than... And, you know, schizophrenics, the same thing. They hear voices, literally.
Yeah.
You know, it may be that there is a part of their brain that is allowing them to hear voices which actually exist.
Mm.
It's not just their imagination.
Yeah.
Right?
So, okay, let me ask you a question here then. So, as Muslims, we do recognize that Shaitan exists. Like, you would not find a Muslim that said Shaitan does not exist, right?
Yeah, but you might find somebody who says that it's metaphorical, right?
Well, these guys are just, you know.
Yeah.
But the majority of the Muslims, at least, they do submit to the fact that Shaitan exists. But how much of them are aware of their inner enemy, though, which is themselves?
Oh, I want to say not that many.
Well, so that's a problem.
I'd probably be included.
So that's
that,
a problem. Yeah. So yeah. I mean, as Muslims, at least, we can concur, we can agree that the fact that Shaitan does exist, he's our enemy. And that's why every time we do something, antullah Shaitan. Allah, like, we're constantly cursing the Shaitan.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes I say, I honestly sometimes feel sorry for the guy.
I'm glad you said that. Well, I used to, when I was a kid, if I ever got tempted to do something bad, right, like break a window or I don't know, like spit. I don't know. Like, what do kids do? Naughty things, right? Like, I'm talking about, like, when I was 7, 8 years old, right? I used to say la'nat on Shaitan, right?
Mm.
When I grew out of that, I started saying, no, it's not Shaitan, it's me. And somewhere down the line, I actually forgot that he exists. And that was detrimental as well.
Yeah,
but anyway, so I want to come right back
to
what
you were
saying.
You've got to keep the balance. Yeah. See, I think with the mystics and Arafat, they mainly talk about oneself, like, you know, and Shaitan, obviously, once you work on oneself, Shaitan becomes non-existent because there's nothing he can approach you with, he can attack you with. So they move to this side.
Yeah.
As for me and you, the common people who are trying to live in a world where it's turbulent and we're trying to, I don't know, fall in either end of a spectrum, obviously we need to keep the balance that I have myself as an enemy, I have Shaitan as an enemy, and I need to work at least on both. So we need to keep that balance at least to say...
Let's end with this story, right? So I think this encompasses both sides of it. Imam Khomeini talks about this in a beautiful way. He says that, look, every soul, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get to the palace of Allah, right? Shaitan is the guard dog of that palace, okay? Now, if a person is sincere and they're truly just going towards the palace for the sake of the palace of Allah, right? In other words, they belong to Allah, the dog has nothing to do with them. Because it doesn't sense any fear, it doesn't sense any kind of hesitation. Mm. This person is going Siratul Mustaqim straight to the palace. But then if you hesitate, if you're like, oh, maybe I want to go back, maybe I want to go do this for my naf, maybe I want to do, the dog will come and get you.
He'll bite you.
Right? So really it's about purifying the self, having that ikhlas, you know, doing it for the sincere reasons. You want to do this for the sake of Allah, whatever it might be, that dog will have nothing to do with you. Inshallah, may Allah help us to purify ourselves and to safeguard ourselves from the shaitan. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa
barakatuh. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.